Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is, what time is it? It's 1:33 p.m. It is Friday, February 25th, 2022. And before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind all committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, Representative Price Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 172, Mental Health Facilities and Meds, sponsored by the House Rules Committees by request of the Governor. This is the fifth hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. On Wednesday, we discussed Amendments 1 through 4 and adopted Amendments 1 and 2 and rejected amendments. Amendment 4 and Amendment Number 3 was withdrawn. At this time, we're going to take up one additional amendment to House Bill 172. By way of background, the Department of Health and Social Services was in contact with our office following our Wednesday hearing and expressed interest in addressing the concerns raised by members of this committee regarding grievance procedures. They propose adding language to the bill that would require a report by the department on grievance procedures. The timeline for this report is 1 year after the effective date of this bill and is in the interest of allowing the department time to confer with the appropriate stakeholders and licensing organizations. As this is an administration bill and this change is meant to address concerns raised by members of this committee, as chair, I am bringing the proposed language before you. We will reopen the amendments so that the department's proposal may be considered by the committee. We have Heather Carpenter from Department of Health and Social Services, Steve Williams from the Mental Health Trust, who will be able to speak to the amendment. We also have Stephen Bookman from the Department of Law to answer any questions. And I'll put on in advance that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. After the amendment is offered, the department will explain the amendment. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. And we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. And we'll begin with Amendment Number 5, Representative Snyder.
I move Amendment 5.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Ms. Carpenter, welcome back. Please tell us about Amendment Number 5.
Thank you, Chair Clayman. For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. As we had a very robust conversation on Wednesday about amendments and processes with grievances, the department and the trust wanted to put forward a solution that would give comfort to individuals who have requested these changes and address the items that I put on the record that we requested a process to be thoughtful, to bring in all the appropriate stakeholders. So even though this amendment says it's a report, I would say it's more of an action plan, and it requires the department and the trust to, as I like to describe, have a big tent and bring in those individuals with lived experience, patient advocates, the Disability Law Center, the ombudsman, those who perform these services, as well as the Alaska Mental Health Board, to work with the trust and the department in a very open and transparent public process to bring forward concerns, to look at what other states have done, to really do that wholesale review. And then it holds our feet to the fire by requiring us to not only public notice a plan after we hear from stakeholders and work with them, take public comment, take that into consideration, and then turn around and provide that report and action items back to the legislature and all of these interested parties. So we know this is something that is very important to address, and we hope this gives some comfort and a process to make that happen.
Questions regarding Amendment Number 5? I don't see any questions. Is the objection maintained?
I think you objected, Chair.
Oh, I object. You're right. I am withdrawing my objection.
Can I object for a comment?
I will keep my objection in place, and you don't need to object, Representative Eastman. We can have discussion. Discussion as to Amendment Number 5. I did get ahead of the script, and I apologize.
Thank you. I appreciate the recommendation here. I think that it'll yield some helpful information. I know the approach that I'm seeing in this amendment is still one level removed from actually, having on-site visits like we were talking about. This is more focused on overseeing the accrediting bodies and their requirements and their processes. And I would still like to see at some point us take some proactive steps to make sure that those on-site visions are taken care of. I think the testimony that came out earlier in the week was that, you know, there was a biannual once every 2 years or so requirement, maybe more often. I'd like to see that a little bit more frequent than that.
Further discussion of the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection to amendment number 5? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 5 is approved. That brings us back to House Bill 175 as amended and final comments. I'm giving members one opportunity to make final comments, and as is the practice, I'll go around the room, and this time we start with Representative Snyder.
No comment, thank you.
Representative Drummond.
I think this is going to help Alaskans, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to weigh in on it. I know we've got a lot of needs, and mental health is really job one when too often these folks end up in prison instead of in a place that can help them. So I am very happy to support this this bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do recognize the need for this to be able to keep people out of the emergency rooms and our jails. But the concern that I have is the involuntary administration of psychotropic medicine. That is something that I just really have a hard time getting past. But I see and recognize that we need to be offering aid in a way that meets them where they're at. And I think that so much of this bill does that, but I'm not able to support it at this time because of the area with the psychotropic drugs. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, rarely do I vote to keep a bill in committee for further work, but I will be today. And I don't believe that we as a committee have done the work that we should be doing on this bill. You know, one of the things that stood out to me from the lengthy submission from the Citizens for Human Rights Commission was their attachment 4, which is a long list of drugs that have effects which are often mistaken for mental illness. And I don't believe that we have adequately addressed that issue in the bill, just to make sure that we're not, you know, putting someone at risk of being involuntarily detained and involuntarily medicated when it's not mental health issue that they're suffering from. It's the fact that the medications that they've taken either intentionally or accidentally are masking, you know, those types of symptoms. And, you know, if we had addressed all of the amendments and so forth, that would be one thing. But, you know, I'll also say give a props to our drafting team for doing their best to get amendments to us today. I know early in the week they had not one but 3 different drafters trying to get amendments to this bill because you know, the main drafter didn't have the bandwidth to be able to go through all the amendments. They turned around amendments very quickly and you know, got those back to us. Unfortunately, they were after the 5 p.m. deadline on Tuesday, but and yet those came back to us on Tuesday. Today we dealt with an amendment that came back on Thursday. I just have to wonder why we're not dealing with all the amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Christ-Tompkins. And I would just note that Representative Vance raised questions about psychotropic drugs, and this bill maintains the status quo on psychotropic drugs. And we actually passed legislation 2 years ago. I think it was Senate Bill. It was Senator Giesel's bill. I'm not going to get the bill number because I'll get it wrong. But that was one about administration of psychotropic drugs and who could administer those. And so we have addressed that. And part of what I think this version of the bill addresses specifically makes no changes in the rights and process for psychotropic drug medication as that it's the same as it is today. We're not taking any rights away as as exists today. And the other thing I just want to note with regard to the Center for gotta get it right before I say it. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights, Alaska, Montana, Washington, that letter dated May 12, 2021, doesn't address the committee substitute, which is substantially changed from the version they were making comments on. And I think the bill that we have before us is a bill that reflects tremendous work by the department, by the trust, by a number of stakeholder groups. And I'm particularly note that we are in a process of a settlement agreement with the Disability Law Center related to access to psychiatric treatment. And the fact that the Disability Law Center has submitted a letter and provided invited testimony supporting the bill, I think is a real positive mark for the administration in terms of working not only to resolve that lawsuit, but to take steps after resolution of that lawsuit to move forward and provide the kind of services to Alaskans that that lawsuit was asking us to provide. So I'm pleased to support the bill. And Representative Snyder, may I have a motion?
I move version 32-GH1730/W of House Bill 172 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
I'll object.
Secretary, you would please call the roll.
Representative Vance?
No.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Snyder?
Yes.
Representative Price-Tonkin?
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Kirkus absent. Chair Klayman?
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
So by a vote of 4-2, House Bill 172 moves from this committee. Our second order of business today is Senate Bill 11, Community Property Trust, sponsored by Senator Begich. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Begich and his staff, Trevor Bailey. Please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Begich. I'm the State Senator for District J, which is downtown Anchorage, Fairview, Mountain View, a little bit of Russian Jack Airport Heights, Government Hill, and South Addition. The bill before you, Senate Bill 11, addresses a community property trust and is a reintroduction of legislation that was introduced by Senator Coghill in the last legislature. We went ahead and picked it up when Senator Coghill did not return to this body. What Senate Bill 11 does is really respond to a reinterpretation of our community trust laws that were established in 1998. Back at the time, Representative Joe Ryan, who's a Republican from Fairbanks, introduced a piece of legislation, HB 199, that established the Community Property Trust Act in Alaska. At the time, the assumption was that within a community trust, that trust would include the appreciation to assets that were signed into or agreed to by folks who joined into a community trust. The issue of appreciation was directly addressed during testimony in the bill. And if I could just quote from Representative Ryan, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind if I read. Quote.
Please.
Quote, when one of the partners dies, the basis is what for the value of the asset is that in which it was purchased and any appreciation of that on behalf of the estate. So those words emphasized any appreciation of the asset. In a recent court decision, the court actually didn't include appreciation as part of the community trust value. And so this issue is one that was clearly intended by the legislation. It is, I believe, been interpreted by the court in a way that brings ambiguity to the law. And this legislation simply attempts to address the ambiguity. I would add that it has no impact whatsoever on any current litigation. And in fact, even has a saving clause in the legislation to ensure that it would not have any impact on legislation that would take effect on any lawsuit that might be filed before the legislation takes effect. This bill passed with strong bipartisan support in the Senate. It's moved through other committees here in the House and is before your committee now. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my staff assistant, Trevor Bailey, and that's B-A-I-L-L-Y. So double
still
L.
Still pronounced.
Still pronounced
the
Bailey.
Usual way.
Trevor Bailey, who will read the sponsor statement, which gives into more detail, and the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trevor Bailey, staff to Senator Bagage. I'm going to begin with the sponsor statement. So Alaska is a state with favorable trust laws and favorable laws for property ownership between spouses. The state allows for opt-in community property ownership between married spouses. Community property ownership can provide tremendous tax advantages to spouses. In Alaska, residents can enter into community property agreements, and residents and non-residents can enter into Alaska Community Property Trusts. This benefits the individuals entering these agreements. The trust industry of Alaska increases deposits in Alaska banks, and through the revenue generated by the formation of a new trust, the state. Community property is simply a way to own joint property. A common way to enter a community property agreement is in conjunction with one spouse. Each party must elect into the agreement, and the agreement provides, most commonly, equal ownership and management of specific property. Currently, community property has a significant tax advantage. When a spouse dies, a community property is placed into a tax category that allows for tax advantages when the property is sold. To realize these advantages, appreciation and income in a trust must be characterized as part of community property. The default rule has generally been that appreciation and income on community property will be characterized as community property unless otherwise declared in the community property trust. Trust attorneys have attested to this interpretation. However, recent court rulings have created an ambiguous understanding of this general criterion. This legislation, consistent with industry understandings of trusts, seeks to clearly define community property as including appreciation and income on community property. Senate Bill 11 establishes a clear definition of appreciation and income as community property as intended by the Community Property Trust Act. Portions of this legislation also have a retroactive effective date of May 23, 1998. And Mr. Chair, if I may, can I move to the sectional analysis?
Please.
All right. So Section 1 clarifies the intent of subsection A under the Alaska Statute 34.77.030 to ensure any financial gains directly related to appreciation of community property trusts are treated as community property unless legal trust documents clearly state otherwise. Section 2 adds a new subsection in AS 34.77.030 to retroactively apply the above changes in statute to community property trust agreements established on or after May 23, 1998. This section also applies any existing statutory definitions of community property trust. Section 3 is the saving clause mentioned by Senator Bagage, and it asserts that Section 2 of this legislation does not impact court actions or proceedings that began before the effective date. Section 4 and 5 both have to do with effective dates. Section 4 is the retroactivity clause, which makes Section 1 of this act retroactive to May 23, 1998. And this is the date that the original Community Property Trust Act was effective. And then Section 5 makes Sections 1 and 4 of this act take effect immediately. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, we're going to take invited testimony. We have three individuals, I think all online, to provide invited testimony on this bill. And the first person is Bill Pearson with Foley and Pearson. Mr. Pearson, if you'll identify yourself. And we generally try to keep invited testimony to 3 minutes, so do your best to stay within that timeline.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Bill Pearson with Foley & Pearson in Anchorage. And if I may, through the chair, just I grew up in Alaska, came back to Alaska, was brought into a trust in the state's practice, and our firm has done estate planning all across Alaska. We have, I'd say, many hundreds of estate plans, and many of them have community property integrated into them. This is an important technical fix. It provides for the important goal of the step up in basis, and it just provides assurances for many, many Alaskans that the community property planning that they entered into receives the step up in basis that they intended to implement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Linda Holbert from New York Life. Ms. Holbert, if you want to put yourself on the record and identify where you're calling from.
Yes, my name is Linda Holbert, and I'm calling you this afternoon from Fairbanks. And I thank you for this opportunity. I have been an insurance agent in Alaska for 33 years, over 33. I have offices in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and so I represent hundreds and hundreds of clients throughout the state. I'm here representing my clients today. This is an important technical amendment that really affects their planning. They're planning for their families, they're planning for their businesses, they're planning for retirement, they're planning for the future and the legacy that they're going to leave behind. The community property bill is one that many of my clients have taken advantage of as they have established wills and trusts and done planning for themselves and their families. As such, and having lived in Fairbanks for over 50 years, maybe 54, 55, and have been an agent for over 30 years, I feel that this really represents the best interests of a vast majority of my clients in Alaskans, and I support SB 11. Thank you for your opportunity.
Thank you very much. And last for invited testimony, we have Matthew Blattmacher with Peak Trust Company. Mr. Blattmacher, if you would identify yourself and tell us where you're calling from.
Yeah. Chair, this is Matthew Blattmacher with Peak Trust Company from Anchorage, and my comments largely mirror Bill's and Linda's. We work with hundreds, if not thousands, of Alaskan clients throughout the state. Many of them use community property. It's a very effective planning tool that Alaska has. And I know in talking with the original, you know, architects of the Alaska community property laws and legislators who were, you know, present for the passage of that, that the intent was always that both of these would be included in community property. This is really just a, in many ways, a technical clarity amendment to what was intended all along. So has my full personal support as well as professional support, and happy to answer any questions if there are any.
So, Senator Begich, did you want to add something further before we get to questions from the committee?
Yes, for the record, Senator Tom Begich, District J. I just needed to note on the record that one of my staff members is one of the Linda Holbert's clients, just as a matter of disclosure. I wanted to make sure that was clear.
Okay. So that gets us to questions from the committee. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I was curious where Mr. Blattmacher was calling in from.
Oh, Anchorage.
Anchorage. Thank you.
I think you said that, but that may have whizzed by. Representative Snyder, did you have? Rep Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, could you speak to why you chose the retroactivity all the way back to 1998 and what effects that may have? I mean, that's a really big window of time, mm-hmm. and I want to understand any potential consequences, either good or bad, that could be had by going back so far.
Sure. For the record, Senator Tom Begich, District J, through the chair to Representative Vance, that's the date that the law became effective. So the law, our Community Trust Act, became effective on May 23rd. So since that date, people who have entered community trusts with the understanding, and I read from the record from when that law was being proposed by the author of that law, there was an understanding that the value of your estate, let's say it was a $100,000 community property trust that you determined, would appreciate over time. So let's say that you were one of the people who took advantage of that law. Today, because of that court decision that was made, that is now ambiguous as to whether your, should your spouse die, whether that property appreciation value over the $100,000 original value would be considered value. And the whole point you enter the community property trust in the first place is to avoid having, you know, it's avoiding a federal tax liability. So there's two things in this bill that directly relate your question, which is exactly the perfect question for this bill. The first is, by going back to that date, you ensure you're holding harmless any of those, what you heard on the record were either hundreds or thousands of community property trusts that have been engaged in here in Alaska. But secondarily, and perhaps more importantly, there's the savings clause that says if any legal action is underway, that action would not be affected by the change in this law. So it wouldn't affect any material, there's no unintended consequence on a pending legal action as a result of this. And in fact, if indeed you had a community property trust and you didn't want that value to be appreciation value to be accrued, and you file a lawsuit before this became law, that would also not be affected by this law. So it is meant for those who truly entered a community property trust with the full expectation that they would get the full value, appreciation value, over 30 years or 20, in this case, I guess it's 24 years. And so you would lose that value otherwise because of the ambiguity, potentially you lose it because of the ambiguity that the courts have caused in this matter. So I hope that answers the question.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Yes, it does. And I wanted that to be reiterated on the record. And the second question that I have is in your supporting documents, the Property Trust Act.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, there's a bolded a paragraph that's in all caps. And it talks about the consequences of this trust may be very extensive, including but not limited to. Would you discuss more of that for the record and how this bill, how this this section is affected by your bill? It's on page
I've got the page. Mr. Chairman, Tom Begich for the record, Senator Tom Begich for the record, through the chair to Representative Vance. This was written in the original Property Trust Act, and it's essentially the reasoning for that is to call attention to what you're getting into when you sign a community property trust document. I mean, that's why it's in bold. It's to call your attention to it, to make you aware of it.
Great. Thank you. I just wanted to highlight that because by first blush of the bill, I didn't feel the seriousness of what these decisions are. And I just wanted to highlight that for the public to take a deeper dive into what this is. And because it sounds like, oh, I could save more money in my taxes, but it is a very considerable financial decision. And I just wanted to be able to highlight that for the record. So thank you.
That wasn't a question, but I'll give you a little latitude. Mm-hmm. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And just to go back to what started the concern here dealing with the court case, has that court case been finally resolved or is that on appeal? What's the status?
Through the chair, Senator Begich for the record to Representative Eastman. I would defer to one of the three folks online because I actually don't know the current status as of today, but I think at least one of those three likely does know the current status in that case. But I would reemphasize, Representative Eastman, that nothing in this bill would have an impact on that case, regardless of how it was resolved. So if, Mr. Chairman, if you maybe...
I'll give Mr. Pearson the first shot at that. What's the current status of the Phillips case following the appeal?
My understanding, it was a final judgment in the Alaska Supreme Court. I'd have to look back at the opinion to see if there was some kind of... Usually there's a remand to the Superior Court. That is one of the reasons why there's the savings clause in there. It excludes any pending actions, and that is one of the reasons why we address that with the retroactive date.
And I'm looking at the opinion, and the conclusion is we affirm the judgment of the Superior Court, and there's no remand. So.
Okay, thank you.
That appears that the case is final.
Case is final.
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And so now that the case is final, it seems like it wasn't just the Superior Court that might have had this difference of opinion on what the intent of the legislature was. Was there something unique or particular to the way this statute was passed that led to that ambiguity? So if nothing else, we can avoid those kinds of mistakes in the future or issues?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, to Representative Eastman. I actually wouldn't, I would say that the ambiguity was that it wasn't clearly stated, which is what the language in the bill is attempting to clear up. As a direct result of that lawsuit, the court gave direction as to what would make it non-ambiguous by saying we're going to consider not only is it ambiguous, but we're going to rule against you. So that led us to the answer of, well, we got to clean that up and make sure that we go back to Representative Ryan's original intent. And that original intent is so clearly spoken to on the record. He goes further. In fact, if I may, Mr. Chairman, read just one more quote from Representative Ryan's testimony at the time. He literally says that, so that asset can be sold, the gains realized, without paying the federal government any taxes. So I'll go back to his phrase, the gains realized. There was a clear intention that the gains were meant to be part of, that's the appreciation. So while the court, what the court has said is we've looked at how you've written this and it doesn't do what that says. And so you need to rewrite the statute. And that's what we have done. And I think this, frankly, I was hopeful it would have passed last legislature, but COVID killed it. So it was one of those things that died because of COVID. But thank you for that question, Representative Eastman.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins, do you have your hand up?
Please. Yeah. Thank you. I'm just reading the court decision, and I think Senator Begich, you said that passage of this bill would not have affected the court decision at all. And I'm trying to understand.
Not exactly.
Oh, could you clarify that statement?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, Representative Christ Tompkins, what I said was that passage of this bill would not affect that case because that case is preserved, would have been preserved through the saving clause, nor would any other litigation, because if litigation were undertaken today, for example, in one of these cases, it would be based on the current law, and the court is clear, as spoken to in the judgment, that the current law does not erase the ambiguity. So what would change would be, under this bill, there would be no longer any ambiguity, and asset appreciation would now be considered clearly part of the trust, as was intended back in 1997, when testimony occurred in 98, when the law became effective.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
I'll make a statement, then let me know if this is accurate or inaccurate. So the statement is, were this piece of legislation passed before us, and the case that went to the Supreme Court, Phillips v. the divorce case that was just referenced in Representative Eastman's question, were taken after passage of this law, that the court in all likelihood would arrive at a different sort of judgment in terms of how those assets would be divided. Is that accurate?
Through the chair to Senator Begich, for the record, through the chair to Representative Christ Tompkins, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Eastman, another question?
Thank you. Yeah, and I'm just looking at I think what we're referring to as the savings clause, and in what are the limitations on how broad that savings clause can be applied? You know, just listening to the question a moment ago, it would seem to me that if a law was passed saying one thing, and then that's going to affect, you know, court cases like the one we're referencing. And then we change it now, but we say it's retroactive. Is there some limitations on how we can use this sort of retroactive provision? It would seem to me we're kind of making two different and opposing arguments at the same time. We're saying, hey, the legislative intent was this one thing, and the court's saying, yeah, but that's not what you did. And then we're saying, well, we're going to do something now to change what we did then. I'm just wondering how the court's going to navigate that in between when the law said one thing and now we're saying, in effect, that the law is now saying something different and it's saying it back in 1998. You see the confusion?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, to Representative Eastman. That's precisely why the two saving clauses, the retroactivity clause and the saving clause, are written as they're written. So up until that court case, the courts had never perceived the interpretation or interpreted it in a different manner. It was only with that court case. So all those 30 years before, any case that would have come before was not interpreted that way, or 20 years before had not been interpreted that way. So what you're dealing with are broad savings clauses and retroactivity, specifically excluding any litigation that might be underway at this time or before the effective date of this bill, precisely to erase that ambiguity and say to the court, it is the legislature's finding in the passage of this bill that this was meant to be retroactive. This was meant to be in existence from the time of the Community Trust Act's adoption. But we recognize that the court may perceive that differently with any active legal action, and so we're recognizing the court's ability to rule based on that legal action that might be underway now, and I'm not aware of any, by the way, but that might be underway now. We're acknowledging that what I might call that threading of the needle that you're describing, because the court does have to wind around those two things if there's active litigation. But at this time, I am unaware of any active litigation. Perhaps someone online would know if there is any active litigation. But our last examination of this, there was no active litigation outside of the one case that originally brought this. So I think that's a great question. And what we're doing on the record now is providing additional guidance to the court as to what our intent is. And I think that's critically important because, as I think you know, it appears from time to time the court misinterprets the actions of the legislature. So let's be clear on the record what the intent is.
Thank you. Final follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So if I'll just assume for a moment, for purposes of discussion, that the court's right that the legislature botched it in terms of how the law was written, and so it did not accurately reflect our intent. And yet you've got attorneys that have been looking at what was written and passed by the legislature for decades now, and have been advising their clients based on what the law actually said, not necessarily what we intended it to say. This retroactivity would now perhaps put them at a disadvantage. They've advised their clients to do one thing based on what the law said, and now we're, in essence, maybe pulling the rug out from under them and saying, well, yeah, that's what it said, but that's not what we meant, and now we're going to apply what we meant over on top of the advice they might have been giving their clients. I'm just wondering, are we maybe putting people at a disadvantage unintentionally?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, to Representative Eastman, I would, based on the testimony that you've just had from at least three people representing upwards to thousands of clients, they all believe that the intent of the law is what the original prime sponsor said on the record, and the advice they've been giving to their clients was that. Consequently, that's why they came to first Senator Coghill and then to myself to ask for this legislation, precisely because they've been giving information to their clients that they believe, based on the intent of the legislature, provided that security of knowing assets and the value of those assets over time, the appreciated value, would be counted as part of your community trust agreement. So I think while I recognize that the question is saying, what if there was an advisor out there who said, by the way, you should know appreciation isn't part of this because they read the law that way, that person would be unique, at least among the community that I've been speaking to who are handling our community property trust. You do have three people online, any one of the three, they're all active in organizational structures within that community, though perhaps one of them would be willing to answer that question from the professional capacity. I think that might also perhaps provide a little more security in the issue that you're bringing up.
No, thank you. I appreciate that you've had that contact. It's helpful to assuage that concern.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. So we are going to hold Senate Bill 11 for further review. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to present.
Thank you.
Our third and final order of business today is House Bill 325, Domestic Violence, sponsored by Representative Rasmussen. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. On Teams teleconference today to present the bill is Representative Rasmussen. And hold on. And here in the room is her staff, Crystal Kieneman. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your remarks. Who's up first?
Can you hear me?
We can. It wasn't clear who was going to speak first.
Oh, no worries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for taking some time to hear our bill today. This is, for the record, Representative Rasmussen. I represent the Sand Lake area in Anchorage. And I have with me my staff, Crystal Kamen. House Bill 325 will incorporate image-based sexual abuse, sometimes referred to as revenge porn, to the definition of domestic violence. Currently, sending or distributing explicit images, it will be included and able to be prosecuted under harassment in the second degree, and it's not considered an act of domestic violence currently or crime involving domestic violence. My staff, Crystal, give a little bit more information on the bill, and then if there's any questions, I will be online as well to answer.
Ms. Kinnaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Kinnaman, staff to Representative Rasmussen. As Representative Rasmussen mentioned, this legislation moves the definition that's contained in harassment in the second degree that relates to explicit images, and it moves that into AS 1866-990-3. Which defines domestic violence and a crime involving domestic violence. We are not modifying the definition that relates to explicit images and the sending and distributing of them. However, we are just moving it into the domestic violence statutes so that that can also be used as a way for victims to receive restraining orders or help them gain protections for them. Mr. Chairman, we also have Public Safety, the Department of Law, as well as Lori Morton from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault here for testimony and for questions.
Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, we'll take invited testimony. I'm showing we have a couple of people available for questions and one person that is providing invited testimony, and that's Lori Morton from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Ms. Morton, if you want to come forward, put yourself on the record, and you can provide your invited testimony. And we try to limit that to 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Advocacy Initiatives Director of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The Network is a membership organization comprised of the Domestic Violence and Rape Crisis Response Centers across the state. Thank you to Representative Rasmussen for introducing House Bill 325. The Network supports adding the sixth element of harassment in the second degree, publishes or distributes electronic or printed photographs, pictures, or films that show the genitals, anus, or female breast of the other person or show that person engaged in a sexual act to the statutory definition of domestic violence and crime involving domestic violence. People who choose to use violence to control partners will use any means necessary to keep control and coerce their partners into doing or not doing things that benefit them. Images such as those being described here can be used to cause ridicule, embarrassment, shame, degradation. They can keep the person being harmed trapped in that situation. They can be very effective weapons, and it's right for us to treat them as such. We ask the committee to support the bill and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me note who is available for questions, and then we'll turn to questions from members of the committee. We have Sergeant Michael Henry from the Alaska State Troopers, Renee McFarland from the Alaska Public Defender Agency, Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law. Are all available to answer any questions that you all may have, as well as the bill sponsor and Ms. Morton. Questions from the committee? Representative Snyder.
All right, please be patient with me as I try to put my question into words here. So I just want to make sure I'm fully understanding the implication. So this sharing of images is already illegal or punishable according to other law, but it's not also considered a component or an aspect of domestic violence. That's my first clarification question.
Representative Snyder, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you. And then follow up, if I may. So can you describe to me the implications or changes in potential punishment or penalty with this being now included under domestic violence? How does that change things? Because, of course, when we're talking about domestic violence, talking about household members, I guess how would sentencing change or what would the impact be with this change?
Let me see if Ms. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, if I could really quick. Department of Law is on, this is Representative Rasmussen for the record. I would say one kind of key piece of it is that this would allow victims to petition the courts for a restraining order if they're experiencing this. And while that doesn't pertain exactly to the punishment, which hopefully Department of Law can speak to, I think it's important to give victims as much safety and peace of mind as possible.
Ms. Schroeder, welcome back to Judiciary. I don't think we had the pleasure of your presentation yet this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the chair to Representative Snyder, the crime of domestic violence is used in several areas of the law, and so there would be some impact in both the criminal code, but also, as Representative Rasmussen noted, protective orders. One of the things is that, for example, if you are going to be charged with interfering with a report of a crime of domestic violence, it has to be a crime of domestic violence. So then this conduct of sending images could potentially be referenced in that crime. It's not going to change sentencing. The conduct we're talking about here is a B misdemeanor. There are specific sentences for crimes of domestic violence, but those are usually for, there's mandatory minimums for assault that is a crime of domestic violence. So, and there's also bail implications. There's special provisions for bail upon arraignment when bail is set that the court can consider when there is a crime of domestic violence. So those are generally the impacts that we would be seeing.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Schroeder, how would this impact the restraining orders? The word just escaped me. Lifeline, help me. Protection order. There we go. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Vance. In order to get a domestic violence protective order, the court has to find that a crime of domestic violence had occurred. And they look to this definition to see if that conduct had qualified as a crime of domestic violence. So that's how that would impact the protective orders.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
And how would this protective order be implemented to help the person seeking it for that added protection? How would this provide them that added protection that they're seeking when it's an image? Because typically it's as if there's been physical abuse. But how would this provide that needed distance when it comes to images?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, one of the things that a court can order in a protective order is for the person not to commit a crime against the person. And since what the conduct we're talking about is a crime, then that would be one of the main things that could occur. So that could happen. I understand your point about contact, but there probably would also be a no contact provision, and then the court would define how they view contact. But that would be the big thing, is that the court is asking the person to stop doing what they're doing. And then if the person violated, they could also be charged with another offense because they are also committing another offense, but then they could also be charged with violating a protective order.
All right, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Always helpful to define our terms. Now, the definition of this particular crime references publishing or distributing. Where do we go to find out what constitutes publishing or distributing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there are places in the law that talk about publishing on the internet. This does not say that specifically, but that would qualify. We use basically Webster's dictionary to define things that are not defined in statute. So distributing would have the common definition, and so would publish. So those two are broad terms.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And is there any number associated? Does it have to be distributed widely, or can it simply be distributed to one other person?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it does not have to be widely distributed. And my trustee assistant here has pointed out that there is a definition in statute, in a different statute, that defines distributes. And I can read that to the committee. It's in 1161.116, which is sending an explicit image of a minor. Distributes mean to deliver an image to another person by sending the image to the other person's computer or telephone. And that would be specific to that statute, but we could look at that for guidance in this statute. They are in the same chapter.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Eastman.
Yeah, and I know this statute specifically talks about not just electronic, but print as well. So it seems like we're already a little bit more broad there. I'm concerned, though, if you're dealing with an image of, say, a teenager, 16, and you're concerned that this image has been shared with someone, and then you take that image to, say, the girl's mother, say, hey, we're concerned. Do you now run afoul of domestic violence? I'm obviously that maybe the person whose image it was would be offended by that, but I don't think the intent was to send it to everyone in the high school, for example. If that's the definition that we're going off of distribute, just one person, I'm concerned that that might be a mistake.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if you are talking about children, that is a different statute. That statute is going to be sending an explicit image of a minor, and that is not a definite crime of domestic violence currently.
Actually, I'm talking about 16-year-olds, so we're not talking about that statute.
Representative Eastman, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, so we're about to take this crime and call it domestic violence. And I'm talking about, so if you're talking about a 16-year-old image, an image of a 16-year-old, and you're distributing it to the victim's mother because you're concerned, are we now calling that, by virtue of this bill, domestic violence?
You mean the 16-year-old whose picture has been taken? Whether or not that person is a victim is an open question because they're 16 and hence the statute may not apply, but we're talking about this.
Yeah, this statute specifically applies to, 16, 17, 18, et cetera. And so regardless of the age there, we know it applies. And how do we keep that sort of behavior from now being called domestic violence if we don't want it to be domestic violence?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, in order to qualify as a crime, the person has to have the intent to harass or annoy. So if the person is showing the photo of the minor to the mother with the intent to harass or annoy the other person, potentially, that could qualify. But it's unlikely that we would be able to reach that mental state. Showing an image out of concern is not an intent to harass or annoy.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
This is Representative. I could just. Thanks.
Representative Rasmussen, did you want to add to Ms. Schroeder's answer?
Yes.
So I know you're on teleconference, and so easier when you're here in the room, just ask for my attention and then I'll call on you, but don't start answering the question until I've called on you, because it looks like you're actually not on Teams but on the phone. But please proceed with your additional answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, I just wanted to note for the committee, I think it's important to remember that in these cases of domestic violence, oftentimes the abuser is doing things to manipulate, coerce, the victim in any way. And, you know, they may feel that they can get that reaction from somebody by showing it to their boss, for example, if they're 16 working, you know, one of their first jobs. And so I think it would be a mistake for us to not consider just distributing to one person grounds for the protective order and, you know, what this bill accomplishes to do.
Representative Easterman, you finished? Any follow-up?
No, I do. I have another question.
Is it the same subject matter or a different topic?
Either way, it's hard to interpret, but related.
Let me give Representative Snyder a chance.
Very good.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding the scenario that you're utilizing to explore questions. Can you please repeat, or through the chair, may I request that Representative Easterman repeat?
Let me put the – what I understand, the scenario is there's a 16-year-old who doesn't – Section 1161.116 does not apply because they're 16, and – let's say it's a picture of that 16-year-old with no clothes on.
But who was showing that picture to whom?
So somebody, not the person who took the picture, is going to the parent of the 16-year-old and showing the parent to say, look, here's a picture I see of your child who's 16. And I, just for purposes of, we don't want to get involved in the situation of the 16-year-old saying to their parent, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing. We're just in the scenario in which the parent is being showed this out of concern, and there's no suggestion that this is somehow a way to make the 16-year-old feel like they're being harassed by showing to the parent. The intention, I think, in your example, is it's well-intended to show the parent the picture.
Yeah, it to be clear, so maybe you've got a boyfriend, a girlfriend, or something, and someone receives the picture and is concerned, don't think they should have received that picture, they go to a parent. Now, maybe the victim in this situation is annoyed by that and thinks that that's very annoying that you showed my picture to my mom. And since that annoying is what captures what makes this a crime, and now they've distributed it, and now we're calling that distribution domestic violence, and that's sort of the logical framework that I just want to make sure we're finding a way not to start walking down that road.
And may I ask a clarifying question so I can follow that?
Absolutely.
Eventually,
Ms. Schroeder's going to have to answer the question.
And perhaps I'm not understanding fully the full definition of domestic violence, but in my reading of Section 1 here in the bill, we're talking about household members. And in this example, that would not qualify, but would that still potentially qualify as domestic violence? Because these aren't household members.
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, in order to qualify for domestic violence, there has to be that household member hook. However, I don't think that you're going to get to a crime in this scenario at all, because the intent to harass or annoy is not
there.
Oh, I'm annoyed that you showed my mom. It's the person has to have the conscious objective to harass or annoy. And I just don't think you get there in this hypothetical.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Representative Snyder? Representative Easterman?
Thank you. And I'm curious. So we're defining domestic violence here, and we're saying that the sharing of these images is part of domestic violence. But the definition that we're using specifically excludes that 15-year-old. So why is it domestic violence if it's an image of a 16-year-old, but it's not domestic violence if it's an image of a 15-year-old?
Representative Easterman, through the chair, this is Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Rasmussen. Any images related to those under 16 would fall under a different statute. They would fall under 1161.116, which is sending an image of an explicit of a minor. And so a different code would apply in those scenarios.
Okay, follow-up?
Representative Easterman.
And so is it the sponsor's intent to not consider that domestic violence since it falls under a different statute? I'm just trying to understand the intent here. 16, domestic violence, 15, not domestic violence.
Representative Rasmussen, Can I respond through the chair?
Representative Rasmussen, please proceed.
Thank you. So I think that this bill doesn't get into the logistics or the statute for changing the age of consent. I think the only way that you could include people, Alaskans that are under the age of 16 in this is to revise the age of consent. And I personally am not supportive of lowering that age at all. So I'm not sure if the representative would like to have a conversation about age of consent, but that's not really what this bill is seeking to do. It's just
we are not discussing age of consent under this bill.
Correct.
We're not going down that road. You're welcome to talk with Representative Eastman somewhere else about that topic. Not today.
But yeah, through the chair, the intent of this legislation is not to make any changes to the age of consent. It's just to update our statutes, which are quite outdated, given the prevalence of electronic images and videos, and how many victims of domestic violence are abused by mental, I'm having a blank too, I guess it's a Sarah thing today, but basically putting somebody in a situation where they're embarrassed or ashamed because of photos that were taken or a video.
Can I follow?
Representative Eastman, yes.
Yeah, I think there's some confusion.
Sorry, I was just digesting the last.
I apologize. I don't think we're at all talking about the statute dealing with consent. We're talking about the statute dealing with the definition of domestic violence. And the way the bill is currently written, it would classify domestic violence as these actions, but only when they're taken with somebody 16 or older. And I'm just trying to figure out why that is. Is it just that we'd have to write a longer bill and we don't want to write the longer bill? Or is there a reason why we are not going and saying, hey, whether you're 15 or whether you're 16, if this happens to you and you're committing these crimes, then you're committing the crime of domestic violence?
Representative Eastman, through the chair. Again, this is Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Rasmussen. When I was looking through this, my understanding was that since there was a specific statute relating to an image of a minor, and we were taking something that was not as explicit and putting that in the domestic violence statutes, that was kind of at least my thinking of it. Happy to have a further conversation with you, talk to Ledge Legal about different scenarios that may apply as we move forward. Thank you,
Sir. Very good. I'll yield.
Vance is next in the queue, and then I'm putting Snyder in after that.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Vance.
Through the chair, either to the sponsor.
Actually, I apologize. I've noted that Representative Rasmussen has your yellow hand raised on Teams. I'm learning. I'm a slow learner on some of these little tricky things. Representative Rasmussen, did you want to add anything to the last answer from your staff from Representative Eastman's question?
Yes, Mr. Thank
please,
you. Through the chair.
Please proceed.
I was just hoping possibly that maybe Ms. Schroeder could highlight the difference in law for distribution of child pornography or explicit images, because it's my understanding that over 16 would be a class 2 misdemeanor, and I'm just curious if she could identify the difference between those.
Representative Rasmussen, you're actually not answering the question, and I'm going to let the committee members get their questions, and hopefully we'll get where we need to go. If those haven't been answered by questions from the committee, then I'll give you a chance to ask questions, but you're actually the one that's presenting the bill, and so Representative Vance is next in the queue. And I apologize. Well, I gave her a chance, but she actually didn't have an answer. She had a question. So, Representative Vance.
Through the chair, this is either to the sponsor or to Ms. Kinnaman. Could you tell us more about how often this is an occurrence of what is often referred to as revenge porn? And the need for this bill. I mean, because we are, this is dealing with 16-year-olds and on up, and obviously this is a come out of a need, but how prevalent is it?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I would defer. We do have public safety on the line. I believe Sergeant Mike Henry is available, and he may be able to answer that in a little more detail.
Mr. Henry.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. This is Sergeant Mike Henry with the Alaska State Troopers. We did do an audit of statistics for trying to get a little bit of that number. Just in doing a little bit of cursory look through it, it's not a real accurate number because it is classifying a variety of harassment issues, and this is just one subsection of harassment in the second degree has briefly has about eight different subsections. So the number that I have is not a great accurate total. The total harassment cases we have for the state is in the neighborhood of about 180, but not all of those are this particular subsection. So I'll have to defer that to Ms. Howell, and she may have an answer for you or may have to get back to you with that.
And just for context, I see Ms. Howell shaking her head, so you don't get the lifeline even though she's in the room. But the one clarification for the answer, 180 harassment cases, I'm figuring second degree harassment, or does that include both first degree and second degree? And then also, what's the time period in which you're counting the numbers?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Sergeant Mike Henry again. So the stats that were pulled on this was from 2012 through current, and that's for things coded as a search for this particular subsection of 1161-120A6. However, in reviewing these, some of those were improperly coded. So even though it pulled up stats of 180 items, it's not all accurately coded. There's a mixture of incidents in here. So I don't have a true number for you. I can tell you the best number that I can give you is I did a separate audit for that same time period, 2013 to present, of cases where charges under this subsection were actually filed, and that number was much smaller, only about nine incidents, total.
And just to make sure we're talking from 2013 through 2021, maybe even the first few months of 2020, you're saying from 2013 through 2021, you had nine cases filed under 1161-120A6. We're not talking nine per year, but nine total. And then you had, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Like I said, unfortunately, there's some limits to the stats and the time that I had to search that. So I would consult with Ms. Howell. We could get back if there's a need for a more in-depth search, we could get back with.
And then the second part of that is that you, not at cases actually filed, but that reports of one form or another where the statute showed up and you identified that number, when you looked at it, some, it was clear that some didn't belong there. They were from a different section, but you had 180 reports under the statute, but again, for that same period of 2013 through 2021. So a 8-year period, if I'm counting right. And 180 cases?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Ms. Kieneman has her hand raised. She wants to add something. Ms. Kieneman?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do want to mention that crimes involving domestic violence are severely underreported. And so while there may not be great statistics regarding this, there's a reason for that. There's a reason why women don't come forward to mention these things and to say anything. And so while there may not be the statistics, there still may need that need for this to be in place.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Kieneman, for just highlighting that, because I wouldn't have thought to seek to report something like this because of, you know, what could the law do type of thing. But on your supporting documents, you have an NCSL brief from August of 2019, and it highlights, it says in their little bubble that Alaska bans revenge porn, but obviously there's some kind of loophole here. And this is on the little orange spot is saying something about one in three victims of sextortion in 2017 said they never told anyone because of shame and embarrassment. And can you speak to why you included this and that loophole that it's telling the public that Alaska is banning revenge porn and sextortion laws, but clearly there's an area that's not because you're bringing forth this bill, and just want to kind of close the gap on that miscommunication.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Through the chair, Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Fasmussen. People believe that Alaska has banned it, and it is in statute. It is in our second degree harassment statutes. However, it's not in the domestic violence statutes, and that's the piece where we're looking to add clarity. So when the courts are looking to issue these protective orders, when they look at what is a crime against a household member regarding domestic violence, they have something to issue that domestic violence protective order, because right now the distribution of images is not included. And so that's the loophole that exists, and that's what House Bill 325 seeks to address.
Thank you.
Representative Snyder.
So I'm going to do a statement and make sure I'm understanding correctly, and then I'll follow with a question. The primary purpose of this bill and including this distribution or publication of these images in domestic violence is primarily to allow protective orders if this were under the domestic violence statute.
That's correct.
Correct. That's the primary implication or result.
Representative Snyder, through the chair, it's also to give victims the ability to know that when it comes to a crime against domestic violence, that this
counts.
Included. This counts.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you for that. That was my understanding. I want to make sure I was correct. So we've been hearing some other scenarios involving teenagers, for example. In most cases, though, those teenagers are not going to be sharing a household. They're boyfriend, girlfriend, 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 boyfriend, boyfriend, whatever it may be. In those instances, if this were to happen to them, their current only option to seek some justice for that would be to turn to the harassment in the second degree statute. Is that correct?
If they are, Representative Snyder through the chair, again, Crystal Keeneman, if they are over the age of 16,
okay, yes,
then this would apply. If they are under the age of 16, then it would be sending an explicit image of a minor statute.
And final follow-up, if I may.
Representative Snyder.
And with this particular, the statute harassment in the second degree, there's no opportunity for a protective order or any other something similar to protect the victim as it stands now. Is that correct?
This is Casey Schroeder from Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Snyder, if charges are filed, and the crime is reported and charges are filed, in any kind of bail setting, the state is going to ask for no contact. And so that would be a mechanism to help protect the victim in that way.
Thank you. I'm supportive of the intent of this bill. Just make sure I understand the full scope and landscape. Thank you.
So, Representative Eastman, I have a couple of questions, and I'll give you a shot because you've had several questions. The requirement here, this is for Ms. Schroeder, the requirement of the household member relationship. If a scenario you've got a couple in their backyard sunbathing with no clothes on, and the next door neighbor climbing the up in the treehouse next door, looks over the fence and sees the couple stark naked in the backyard and takes pictures and starts distributing those pictures. Is there any ability to charge the neighbor with a crime of domestic violence?
Mr. Chairman, as long as there is not the household member hook, and I'm sure you've read the definition of household member, then it would not be a crime of domestic violence.
What about a couple? Doesn't matter whether they were married or not, but they were a couple for a period of time, living together for a period of time, and then they split up. And a year has passed since they split up, and during the time they were together, they seem to have the habit of taking pictures of one another in an unclothed state. And now a year later, one of them starts distributing those pictures that they had from when they were a couple. Is that something that could be charged as a crime of domestic violence if this bill becomes law?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it could. In the definition of household member, it talks about adults or minors who live together or who have lived together.
And then the third question relating to Representative Snyder's, kind of a follow-up on hers. Let's take two 17-year-olds, minors but over 16, and they had a dating relationship, and while in that dating relationship, they too took pictures of one another. And then something happened, or maybe nothing happened, but one of them decides they want to start sharing pictures. Can that person that's sharing the pictures be charged with a crime of domestic violence in that setting?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Again, with the definition of household member, it talks about adults or minors who are dating or who have dated. And again, I want to just qualify all of my answers with, as long as there is the intent to harass or annoy. So as long as we have met the elements of the crime itself, then we can look at whether or not the person qualifies as a household member.
Okay. Then the other query I have is relating to the bail consequences. It's adding subsection 6A6 of the harassment statute as a crime of domestic violence. If someone is charged with the crime of harassment and the circumstances are one of the domestic violence relationships, what is the impact on bail discretion for the court, because we now have a crime of domestic violence as opposed to a non-domestic violence harassment charge?
Mr. Chairman, there is a specific statute on point for release in domestic violence cases. That's 1230.027. And the crux of that statute essentially talks about contact and when contact can or cannot happen. And again, it is in the discretion of the court. The court has to evaluate all of the factors, but there is a clear emphasis on no contact. So,
does the harassment in the second degree being a Class B misdemeanor, what kind of bail, if it's a first or second offender, what kind of bail is typically going to get applied to somebody that's charged with harassment in the second degree?
Mr. Chairman, if the person doesn't have any criminal history, this is their first offense, it is a B misdemeanor, likely it would be an OR release with conditions, and one of them being no contact.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I just want to get on the record. I know under federal law, a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence can often trigger loss of access to firearms. Do you know, would this type of conviction trigger that kind of action under the Lautenberg Amendment?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am hesitant to speak about the federal law because I'm not that clear on it. I think the Department of Public Safety is a little better on that topic than I am, so I would defer to them.
Thank you.
Sounds like Mr. Henry.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Henry with the State Troopers. I would have to defer again to that just to make sure there wasn't something that I'm unaware of. Generally speaking, it's general across the board that crimes of domestic violence do apply there, but I would have to research that and get back to the committee.
And just by chance, Ms. Howell in the back of the room? All right, we got it. She's holding her holding your hand up suggesting a small lifeline, not necessarily a complete lifeline.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and Representative Eastman through the chair. I believe for it to be a prohibitor to possess or purchase firearms or ammunition, the crime involving domestic violence has to involve an element of force. So in that instance, this would not qualify. However, I will follow up to confirm that, but I don't have my my federal firearm prohibitors with me today.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And to close the loop, so distributing, you know, images would not ever be considered involving force, right? I mean, yeah. Just want to make that clear. If we can find that answer, I'd love to nail that down.
Representative Eastman through the chair, Kelly Howell again for the record. I do not believe so. I think that's a legal question that law would probably have to respond to, but it does not seem sending an image does not seem that it would involve the element of force, but that is a legal question that I defer to the Department of Law.
Great. Thank you. Follow up?
Last one, and then Representative Vance gets a chance for starting to run out of time, and if others have questions, I'll give them an opportunity.
I know that the statute we're dealing with here sort of make an exception for instances when we're not dealing with images that involve nudity. Where do we go to find the definition of that exception? And that's at the end of subsection 6, paragraph 6. So for the images that don't involve nudity, there's another category of images. Where do we go to find the definition of what's included there?
Do you mean in paragraph 6, show that person engaged in a sexual act?
Yes. Where do we go to find out what that means?
Specific about what language, because your question was kind of ambiguous.
Yeah, I don't necessarily need gory details. I'm just wondering where do we go to find the definition.
Ms. Schroeder, welcome back.
For the record, again, Casey Schroeder, Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, are you asking for the definition of sexual act?
Yeah, as it would be used in this case. And a citation is more than enough.
I am looking. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it is 1141-470.
Okay.
Subsection 6. Sexual
Great.
Act means sexual penetration or sexual contact.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. No further questions.
Representative Vance.
Mr. Chairman, for the sake of time, I think I may hold my question for a further hearing.
Well, we have about 3 minutes.
Okay.
Well,
I'll make it count. This question is for Ms. Howell. I do apologize for the musical chairs.
No need to apologize. It's just nice to have people in the room. Easier to hear them and easier to understand them.
Through the chair, Ms. Howell. Because this would be now classified as domestic violence, if an individual in their distress of learning that their explicit image had been shared called 911 and reported that, because it classifies as domestic violence under this bill, would an automatic arrest have to be made of the individual who distributed it?
Representative Vance through the chair, for the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner for Department of Public Safety. Crimes involving domestic violence, if committed within 12 hours, do require a mandatory arrest. Again, we have Sergeant Michael Henry online who can speak to that as a law enforcement officer. So if you'd like additional information about how that occurs, he could answer that question.
Mr. Henry, we do have enough time for you to answer that question. So please, Representative Eastman, this is going to be the last question.
Well, I don't have any more questions.
Representative, Mr. Henry, if you could add further input, if if this becomes law and you get a call that in the last 12 hours somebody published a picture of somebody that's as described in subsection 6 of the harassment statute, would you have to arrest them?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Sergeant Mike Henry again for the record and members of the committee. The answer to that would be it's not just a matter of if the crime is reported, but if after investigation, if we establish probable cause to believe that the crime happened, we have to establish two things, basically. Well, three, I guess. Probable cause to believe that the crime occurred, that it believes that it occurred between household members, so that special relationship, and that if it happened within 12 hours, those, if all of those things are in place, then yes, the mandatory arrest rule applies. And if we had all of those things together, it would be a mandatory arrest if after 12 hours or if there was not that special household relationship, then the mandatory arrest does not apply.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, that gets us right up to the last hour, so we're going to hold House Bill 325 for further review. Thank you very much for all the questions and engaged participation. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, February 28th at 1 p.m. We are done with budget closeouts, so there'll be no more 1:30 starting dates unless other things get in the way. On Monday, we will hear House Bill 372, Eliminate Minimum Wage Exemption, sponsored by Representative Tuck. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 372, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Tuesday, March 1st. It is my intention to take up amendments to House Bill 372 during our meeting on Wednesday, the 2nd of March, and then pass the bill out of committee following final questions and discussion. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is 3 p.m.